This is Elizabeth Wood, and I'm very glad to teach this special class today on three really special formulas that are very close to my heart. And I call them equations because at the root of their existence, these three things I'm going to talk to you about today are equations. And they're three very different equations. But let me explain a little bit more about what this class is and what it's a part of. I encourage you to sign up for my newsletter if you can. That way you get first news about anything new that's going on, especially the next several classes I'll be teaching. They're part of a series of classes that I'm leading up to, building up a group of core people who are teachers and practitioners out in the world, giving them some tools that really haven't been put together in the format that I intend to put them together before. So very special, but also some tools that have been sitting very literally in a closet for over a decade because it wasn't time to teach it yet. And this year I got really clear push. I might even say that I got a download, and I don't really get downloads very often, ever. Maybe once in my life have I had an actual full-blown download of sorts, and this was my second time I've ever had an event like this happen, where I literally could see exactly what I needed to teach this year and why. And that's just fabulous, so I'm very excited about it. The first three classes, this is the first one, is part of a series of three classes. So they're sold separately, but this class, the Equations for Enlightenment, is part of three that I call Applied Multidimensionality. And you'll see what I mean as we get through these classes. The next two are, the next one is called Soul Skill Sets 101, and I'm going to walk you through all the soul skill sets and how you can utilize them in your daily practical life, right? And then the third class of this series is all about time, the playground of time, and how to work with time in a new way. And this, of course, allows you to apply your multidimensional reality in the 3D, which is what we're here to do, right? So we're here to really be a bridge, each of us, a bridge between the material world and all of these other higher dimensions of formless light and power. And then after that series, I'm going to be teaching another group of classes, another three separate classes, that I call Mastering Multidimensionality. So then we'll be getting into doing things like quantum remote viewing, not just regular remote viewing, but quantum remote viewing and applied alchemy, and also, of course, healing the DNA, healing quantum DNA. So those are the sorts of subjects we'll be covering over the next 6 months, one class per month. And they're all building up to something really spectacular. They're building up to my finally being able to share some of the theoretical work I've been doing over the past 20 years. And being able to teach people how to use it. And so certainly I will hope that folks will be able to join me for all of these classes and then be able to join me, of course, in person in June at Crestone, Colorado for a special retreat where I will be teaching these theoretical principles and skills in person. And then we get to do some really excellent field work. No better term to excite an anthropologist from within than to say the word field work. So we're going to be going to Egypt in November. And please do sign up for my newsletter so that you can learn more about all of this and be able to be up to date on what's happening with these different events if you like. But in Egypt, we will be applying all of the things that I'm going to be teaching people. I told one of my friends, this is the master's degree I've always wanted. So I'm taking everything I've learned over all these years and my continued mastery of those subjects and turning it into a way for people to understand somewhat highly complex concepts, but also apply them to their life, because that's the bridge between the material and the spiritual. That's the bridge between science and the spiritual work that we were all doing. And of course, the ultimate goal personally is always the same. We're here so that we can reach higher states of consciousness. And so today I get to share with you the three beautiful equations which have helped me attain higher states of consciousness faster than anything else. And the measurable proof behind these wonderful equations can be found in your daily life, but it can be found, of course, also in the expressions of other people who've utilized these same concepts. So we have a lot of body of sort of modern work around these three things and these three formulas. And of course, how to apply them today, we'll be talking about that. I'm going to guide you on a little bit of a journey through these three equations and how you can use them. So let's get started. I'm really happy, especially to speak about this first equation, because it's not involving numbers, but processes. And it's an equation because it's a set of exact steps that you can use to attain the same result. So if we were to say A plus B plus C equals D, or in this case maybe E, enlightenment, that's this equation we're talking about. So what is A, B, and C? And how do they combine to allow you to bring in more light and therefore attain higher states? That's the cool part. So this series of actions taken daily does an incredible thing, not just to your spiritual embodiment, but your actual physical body and your mind. This series of steps, A plus B plus C, allows you to shift egoic structure out of the way in a very final way, right? We want to have a final outcome every time we use this equation. We want to have results every day. So let's talk about how do these three steps remove density, egoic structure, which has always been really what we're focusing on as people who want to attain higher states. We're talking about egoic structure. That's the thing that we're trying to shift out of the way. We're shooting for formlessness. Formlessness allows more light in and allows enlightenment to be cultivated. And so the first step, A, would be, of course, self-assessment. So self-assessment is the first part of our first equation. How do you do self-assessment? I'm hoping to do a whole video on this, because self-assessment, we could actually teach an entire class on it, which maybe we should. So I'm going to put that on my list of things I should probably talk about. So self-assessment, it's you noticing where there's egoic structure. Now, even to get into that mindset of you being able to notice egoic structure is a huge leap in consciousness. And so how do we find egoic structure? What kind of assessments do we need to use to actually self-assess properly and discover that structure? Well, the first way, because there's multiple ways, and so we can all use that. We can use these new ways and, of course, old ways that we've used before that worked for us, and certainly all of us being able to share the different ways that we self-assess, that's always really helpful. But in this case, the first way is to be able to notice reactions and triggers. What is a reaction and a trigger? Some sort of situation is going to have a certain frequency of energy. And so throughout the day, you're coming across situations that have specific frequencies of energy. Brushing your teeth. There's a certain frequency of energy going on in that situation. Going to get groceries, pumping your gas. Normal, everyday activities create energy. Energy is always flowing and moving. Nothing's ever staying the same. And as it moves around, some of that energy is moving kind of fast. And when that energy is really built up some momentum, it can try to move through you in your field. So what does a fast, intense energy look like? Well, what if you were at the grocery store and the person in front of you was having a hard time, perhaps even getting really angry and yelling at people around them, maybe even yelling at you? And that's going to be a very intense energy buildup. So anger and frustration and suffering, they have these really specific frequencies. And again, they're not staying still. They're not exclusive, hanging out only in the bubble that that person's creating. No, definitely not. It gets thrown around. It gets thrown at you. Even if you're across the store, you can feel it. So that frequency of energy is moving through your field. If there is anything that is there that it can ping, which means it's going to hit that solid egoic structure. If there's anything there that it can ping, then it will. So if there's no attachments, expectations, judgments, or resistance, then you're not going to have a lot of reaction or triggers. That's the goal. But if there's structure there, if there's suffering that's happened, if there's trauma, that's going to create that egoic structure. And that egoic structure reminds us of painful events, and then we have a reaction to it. And that reaction certainly, although perhaps we've forgiven the people that we were involved with terrible past events or done clearing work, that reaction can still be there because there might be still some kind of egoic structure in the way. And egoic structure is often categorized in four categories, which I just named: attachment, expectations, judgment, or resistance. So I want to give you an example of how you can switch your mindset to be in self-assessment mode, to be in the witness, witnessing how your body and how your emotions react, because those reactions are your clue that there's more density there. If you don't have any reactions, then you know you've cleared the density. And certainly, you know, we really do tend to beat up on ego and egoic structure pretty badly, don't we? But I think it can be quite unfair because egoic structure teaches us very much. It teaches us, it really moves us forward faster if you're willing to take a try at shifting it. And so that's really the great desire behind self-assessment. I want to shift any reactions or trigger or density that's keeping me from attaining more light, gaining more light, and retaining that light. So how did all of it get there? Well, like I said, trauma is the number one way egoic structure will end up being put into your experience. And not just your own trauma, but the trauma of your ancestors is there as well. Sometimes people say, I feel like I'm not at home in my body because I inherited all these problems that aren't mine. I feel frustrated by that. And it's really hard for me to move through this life because I don't feel like my body is at the same place spiritually as my soul is. I hear this complaint from many people, and certainly all of us have had moments where we're like, wow, being human is hard. At least, right? At least that kind of reaction. So we're really asking ourselves, how can we make it easier to be human? That's kind of what this journey is about, and that desire to have a way to get at and understand that egoic structure is number one. Willingness to change is key. So that's why we want to tackle that structure, because it doesn't allow formlessness, and formlessness would feel like no reaction or no triggers. So, of course, we need to, once we notice that we have a reaction in our body, we're kind of separated from it already. If you're noticing that and you're saying, oh boy, I have a trigger. I need to go into that. I need to understand what this is. So let me give you an example of how that looks on the fly, how it looks in practice, how self-assessment really looks, even in like a challenging, difficult moment, how that looks. So recently I had a friend, very powerful healer, and she and I have very different styles. And it was shortly after my dog died. And she happens to be able to speak to animals. And so she was kind of doing a reading on my dog a little bit. And she also was doing some pretty intense clearing on me. And her style is kind of intense for me because she speaks really loudly and she kind of prays over you. And for me, it triggered me really bad. Like I had a huge amount of intense emotions coming up in my body as she was on the phone with me doing this reading, clearing kind of seeing that she was doing. Her style really triggered me, right? So my first realization is, wow, I'm really uncomfortable. Why? See, I wasn't going to blame it on her because it had nothing to do with her. That's always a huge thing. You know, we don't blame it on the lady in front of us in the grocery aisle who's yelling at whomever. We don't blame it on anybody that we have triggers. We don't blame it on the past. You can't do any of that. In the moment, you've got to step out of that and really go dig down deep into the feeling of it. And that's part of what self-assessment is all about. So if you're brave enough to do self-assessment, then you're really on the right track. So then I went into the emotion and I'm like, why am I resisting this? Because that's how it felt. I felt like I was resisting the energetic work she was trying to do. And partly it was her style that was getting to me. Because if it was done in a different way, I might not have been triggered. So I'm like, wow, why am I resisting this? Why do I have such a problem with this? And then I dug in. I'm like, it's partially the style that she has. And it reminds me of moments in time in the past where I had people pray over me that I didn't get to choose. I didn't have a choice, right? So there were times where my freedom around what was spiritually happening to me was taken away. And then I said, okay, so there's where the resistance is. Deep down inside, it reminded me of not having a choice, of not having my freedom. And so that wasn't anyone's fault. You know, in the past, my family thought they were doing the best they could, right? And although it traumatized me to an extent, I don't have any blame to put anywhere. There's nothing that needs to be blamed. That's really important. It's really easy to go into a trigger and say, well, this is here because my family abused me, or this is here because of this horrible experience I had, or my mother was afraid because she had a bad experience and then taught me how to be afraid, or things like that. It's okay to notice why something might be there, but it's different to sit there and say, well, this is here because, and then end it there and say, you know, it's my mother's fault. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. In that moment, then, I was just assessing, what is this attachment that I have to being able to choose what kind of style someone uses when they pray with or for or over me? And do I have any certain expectations that I'm attached to that aren't being met? What about my judgment, right? I noticed that her style was different than mine, very, very different. I don't have any judgment on her, except inside that trigger there was a little bit of judgment, thinking about how it was related to other times that I've had people pray over me or experiences I've had. So I was really sifting through, is this a judgment? Maybe a little bit. Is there some resistance? Yes, definitely resistance. So you got to systematically, really mindfully in the moment, notice your emotions, go down into them, see what feelings and past pieces come up for you around that, and then ask yourself, does it fall into any one of these four categories? Attachments, expectations, judgment, or resistance. And then you have to go into another set of steps. So that's my personal way of being able to do self-assessment. Step one in our three-part equation that equals more enlightenment or higher states of consciousness. So self-assessment. I'd like to hear from you now, if possible. I want to make this a bit more interactive. I'm really good at sitting and lecturing for hours. But I'd like to talk with you all, because certainly your methods of self-assessment are going to be a little bit different. But self-assessment, nonetheless, while it can be different from person to person, still is part of this equation. And let me say the equation fully out loud, because I haven't yet. The equation is self-assessment plus mental, emotional, and physical processing. So we can just say processing. Self-assessment plus processing plus meditation equals enlightenment or higher states of consciousness, at least, right? That's what we're shooting for. Processing is how we shift the structure out of the way. First, we have to discover the structure. What are some things that you do that you might like to share that help you to find that egoic structure within, to find ego within you? How do you do that? What are the ways that you use to look for that? I'm really curious to what that might look like for you and how it's different than the process I just described. And you're welcome to write a little bit about it on the Q&A board. Or, of course, raise your hand and press star 2 and we can talk live. Anda from Tarzana asked, where do you sign up for the newsletters? Go ahead and go to my website, seerandscientist.com, and you'll be able to sign up for newsletters there. Either lower down on the homepage, there's a sign up button area, or you can just wait a moment or two, and there'll be a little pop-up that welcomes you to sign up for the newsletters. So thanks for making that mention. Yes, so returning back to self-assessment, what specific ways have worked best for you to go in and really assess where there's egoic structure? And again, if you'd like to speak with me live, press star 2. And if there isn't any that's okay too. So we can move forward. I think that that method of self-assessment, just noticing what reactions and triggers there are and finding out what kind of structure exactly are you dealing with, is a very good way of doing quick in the moment self-assessment and even deeper self-assessment when you have time. Very good. So Nicole mentions self-assessment, self-reflection, noticing triggers, observing what you're projecting on others, and that her kids actually show her a lot of where you're not aware of some sort of structure in the way. You're sure right. Kids do that wonderfully. So we can actually value the challenging, you know, kids aren't always challenging, but we can really value challenging relationships because then they show us where reactions and triggers are. And when you're in a challenging situation and you don't have any reactions or triggers, that's how you know you've fully cleared this structure out of the way. Good. All right. So it sounds like that's pretty complete according to what everyone else has experienced. Yeah, and Nikki also points out here, if I'm with another person and I start giving advice, I immediately know that I've been triggered. When you find yourself trying to fix somebody else, oh boy, I think that's really valuable. I too also find myself giving unsolicited advice a lot because I have some pretty big attachments. I have attachments to outcomes. You know, certainly a session is a very different thing, but in my personal life, I've spoke very clearly about trying to unattach myself from my husband and his job, right? His own, he runs his own business. He's a producer of music. And always finding myself butting into his stuff, trying to guide him, trying to lead him, trying to pull him, tug him in certain directions, and believing that I'm doing that for his highest good, that's huge. That's a huge attachment. And by recognizing my attachment to it and unhooking myself, unhooking my hooks from him, being able to see how much better it is for everyone involved now that I'm not keeping all that egoic structure in the way, we can have a better relationship now. And it's really quite incredible to witness that in yourself and say, wow, I really am really attached to this person or this situation or this outcome. I'm ready to be done with it. So then, of course, now is the next step, processing all of that out of the way. Moria mentions also, I notice that when I'm up against something, the self-assessment that happens is extremely subtle and more energetic than intellectual. I find that I'm not good at releasing the energies because they're enormous. Yes, so speaking certainly from the experience of a very powerful empath who's energetically noticing density in the way and having trouble shifting it out of the way. That's where this next step, processing, is going to come in handy. Very good. And then just in general, Susan says, well, I find interactions with humans the best way to discover triggers. That's for sure, because most of the time we're not necessarily, and of course there's plenty of cases where this isn't true, but we're not necessarily triggered the most by animals and plants. We get triggered the most by humans. Yeah, so if you're spending a lot of time alone, you might not have as many opportunities for triggers. Isn't that funny that we would value those opportunities for triggers? Yes, absolutely. You should value them. They're going to give you a chance to shift something really dense out of the way. All right, then we get into actually processing all of this out. So in our equation, self-assessment, processing, meditation, all of these things added into your day every day creates higher consciousness. Let's talk about mental processing, the first of the three types of processing. Mental processing can lead really nicely from you noticing your own triggers, then to you trying to categorically understand where that trigger comes from. So, for example, in my situation with my friend, I noticed that I had this trigger and that it had to do with some judgment and resistance. And so digging into that, then I went into some serious mental processing immediately, because I recognized that although, yes, I've had multiple experiences where I had people praying over me that I might not want them to, but didn't have a choice as a kid, perhaps, right? This is still too microcosm. So we need to mentally understand why this trigger's even there still, after all these years, why the pattern is coming up again. So the pattern's often linked to something we can mentally put together, which is a polarity. So in my case, it was my lack of control around who's praying over me and how they pray over me that really was triggering me. And that points to a big polarity. And it's a polarity that certainly is going to show up in other parts of my life, not necessarily when people are just praying over me in a style that isn't mine. And that polarity, that noticing or recognizing that polarity, is the first step to mental processing. We need our mind, our brain mind, to really be able to wrap itself around what kind of density we're dealing with. So one of the best ways to make sure you don't find yourself in a blame game is to immediately ask yourself, now that I know what kind of structure I'm dealing with, either attachment, expectation, judgment, or resistance, now I need to understand the pattern behind this. And so the pattern is always going to show up as a polarity, always. There really isn't any exceptions to this rule. In fact, if you really try hard, you'll find that most of the experiences we have can easily be put into polarities. And these polarities are really important, because in this experiment in consciousness, polarities give us a chance to find the middle ground, to heal a polarity. We really must understand all aspects of that polarity and then find the middle way. Find the flowing way, the simple path, the compassionate path, the way that goes between the two big, huge, staunch polarities. In this case, the polarity I was dealing with was control versus lack of control. And of course, wow, who can't possibly apply that to their life, right? Now, there is a particular technique to unwrapping the importance of this polarity in your life. Because the structure is being triggered by a certain action, then that's going to show you that there's been lots of actions, perhaps, that you could really dig into where you feared not being in control. And that's one corner of a more complex way of mentally unwrapping this huge structure in your way. And this particular technique is called squares. And this technique was developed by a woman named Leslie Temple Thurston. And you can buy her book, The Marriage of Spirit. And I highly recommend that you do, because there's many different mental processes within this book. The one that I favor the most and that I want to show you how to do today, it's fairly straightforward. But once you've finally figured out what exactly is the foundation of your trigger, and I'll name some other polarities, worthlessness and arrogance. That's a really big one. Of course, we have the victim and the tyrant. A lot of times we find ourselves feeling victimized over and over and over again in our lives. That's a sign that there's egoic structure there, and also a patterned polarity tied to that structure that's going to show up over and over again until we heal what that polarity really is within us. But we must understand it first with our brain before we can truly heal it. So that's why mental processing is really important. So this technique, squares, what you'll do is you'll find the polarity you're dealing with. In this case, control versus lack of control. And I like to actually use paper for this because it can be very valuable to help keep your thoughts in order. Eventually, as you get better at it, you'll be able to do it quite quickly without paper. But what you want to do is you'll basically put two new squares underneath each polarity. And under each, you're going to be describing moments in time in your life where you feared, for example, fearing lack of control. And you're going to describe moments in time in your life where you desired lack of control. Certainly, there's times in your life where being in control was not what you wanted. It wasn't the ideal situation. But where were those times? How exactly did they emotionally affect you? And then there's going to be fear and desire underneath the other side of the polarity too. So fear and desire around worthlessness or arrogance, fear and desire around control versus lack of control, fear and desire around the victim, being the victim or being the tyrant. Where were there times in your life where you feared being the victim or desired being the victim? Or feared or desired being the tyrant. And what we find when we do this is we mentally start to see how this polarity has shaped the way we view the world. This is really necessary because the brain mind doesn't like to make major changes when it comes to spiritual orders. When you tell the brain mind as a soul what to do, it can be quite stubborn. So one of the things I teach is heart commands, which we're going to be getting into shortly, and that's physical processing. Well, you can try to do a heart command on your brain, but most of the time it'll fight you. There's several reasons for this. Partially, in order to survive better, our brain minds had to function quite separately from the body. If the brain mind was doing everything the body wanted, then we would be in a very different situation on the planet. Because the body's got its own desires and its own ideas about how things should be working. Oh, I'm cold, so we can't be out here. We need to go inside where it's warm. Even though we have to do this work outside, I can't. We have to go inside. The body's going to try to convince the mind that you have to go inside. But the brain mind overrides it, right? We call it mind over matter. So the brain mind really must be approached separately on purpose. And so then the brain mind says, nope, we still got to get this job done. We're going to do it as fast as we can, and then we'll warm up. So the brain mind has some override capabilities, which is why we need to approach it first when we're doing processing. We need to get the brain mind to recognize that there's structure in the way that we're wanting to deal with. Good. So with that basic mental processing, what you're doing is you're listing out your experiences and your feelings and your initial reactions and emotions to the polarity that you've discovered in regards to the structure that's in your way. This sounds more complicated than it is. And it can be very profound to sit down and realize, wow, I have desired certain things in my life and didn't really realize that I was desiring to be the victim in these different cases, or desiring to not have control, or having a desire to be in a position where I am in control versus when I didn't want to be in control. And so that really shows you where that structure is and how it's related to your experiences. Very good. Once that happens, once you've really brought out your experiences in this squares process, and you've recognized where you've desired or feared certain aspects of the polarities you're dealing with, then it's a good time to go into your emotional processing. Because by this time, all the details that have been creating that structure within you, all the fine weavings of experiences, will start to unravel in front of you. And that's when lots of emotions begin to come up. So, for example, at one point, I realized that I had actually created an interesting and kind of vividly painful polarity in my life around banishment and acceptance. And the magic, getting really deep into this, I started to realize that there were times that I had desired banishment, and it threw me into really deep emotional processes around desiring banishment. And, of course, being afraid of banishment, but really those times when I desired banishment is what got me down really deep into some difficult emotions around my arrogance. Oh, that was big. So when I was going in, then I started to feel really intense emotions and that I had never felt before. And that was a sign to me that I was onto something really big, because I had no memory of really having moments of desiring banishment. But when really asked or confronted by that mental process, the squares process, it brought it out for me to be able to examine it. And that's when you know you're on the money, because that's going to bring up lots of intense emotions, as it did for me. Then that's when you're going to use a good emotional processing technique. My favorite technique is one that my teacher Lucia Renee does and teaches. I highly recommend that you look at her processes. She has a free MP3 on her website, luciarenee.com, and her name is spelled luciarenee.com. You can go to her library and then go to Emotional Processing Instructions. I encourage you to listen to that MP3. It's incredibly valuable. And what she does is she helps you understand the mechanics behind processing and perception. So first, we're working on our perception, aren't we, when we do the self-assessment piece. And then we get into the processing. We're trying to bring up all these hard feelings. We're trying to, because that helps you to unravel the density of the structure within, the egoic structure, that really literally has a very physical effect on you. It's quite heavy, and it's very complex, and it's woven together like an internal program in your DNA. It causes all kinds of problems. And keeping density and ego in the body can create physical issues. It can create spiritual issues, and certainly you won't be able to attain more light and gain more light. So that's really key, being able to welcome difficult emotions. So her processing technique basically is based in welcoming, noticing where the discomfort is in the body. As I'm looking at all these things around my process around fear of control or desire of control, fear or desire for lack of control, all these emotions are coming up in my body. And that's wonderful news. That means the emotional body beginning to unwrap the egoic structure, and you'll be able to feel it physically. That's when you want to go in and begin to welcome layer by layer all the different emotions that come through. And this is the hardest part of this three-step formula. The hardest part is welcoming discomfort. But if you're willing and if you're brave, then you'll go in one layer at a time. You're not going to let up. You're going to keep welcoming it. I welcome this pain and discomfort in my heart and my chest. When this my friend is praying over me, I welcome this discomfort. I welcome the discomfort in my tummy. I welcome it as it moves and shifts into my throat. I welcome it there, one step at a time. Emotional processing can take quite a bit of time. But if, again, if you're willing, this is one of the number one things you can be doing for yourself to shift egoic structure out of the way. It's the heart of this equation, assessment, processing, and meditation equal enlightenment. And it is proper emotional processing that allows us to embody many dimensions. So when we welcome it, you'll find that it'll shift, it'll move. And if it suddenly disappears, then that's a sign you're going to need to go back deeper into it. Because it won't suddenly disappear, though your body might try to avoid it. And so that's okay. That means you'll just kind of try to keep on top of it best you can. And as you can imagine, this takes a certain amount of time every day. I highly suggest putting aside time to assess, to process, and to meditate in that order, if possible, especially towards the end of the day, when you can really assess what's happened during that day, process it mentally, emotionally, and physically. And then when you've moved density out of the way, then we meditate and we bring in certain qualities of light, which we'll discuss how to do as well. So when we welcome these difficult emotions, they're going to begin to shift. They'll change. They might feel really uncomfortable or hot or tight. I've seen emotions, you know, bounce all over the body. One minute it's in somebody's shoulder, the next minute it's on the top of their head. So emotions are showing you, hey, there's structure all over. There's structure all over the place. Every time a little bit is unraveled and welcomed, and we welcome that discomfort there, I welcome this discomfort in my shoulder. I welcome it here in my head. And we keep welcoming it. We keep moving through it. It unravels throughout our body. That's why it shifts and changes. So it begins to unravel, and you can physically feel it move and change. And then it begins to dissolve. Because all that structure is being welcomed so fully, emotionally, and you've mentally understood it so well, making sure your brain's on board with the next pieces, then once the brain is, the emotional body gets on board. And then you're in a place where you feel it dissolving and you don't have any physical, emotional reactions anymore. And that's wonderful. Then that's the perfect time to do some physical processing. So physical processing is where you utilize the field of the heart to command energy. Once all those little bits and particles of that what once was a really huge boulder, then it got broken down mentally. Once you understood, oh, this boulder, judgment and resistance. Fear of lack of control. Wow, big, huge boulder. Then we break it down with that mental processing. Where are all the different experiences I had? And then we go in and we emotionally process it. We break it down even more into more dissolvable bits. And then you can physically shift all the dust out. And so physical processing is the next big piece, much easier to do than emotional and mental processing. And let me show you how to do a basic physical process where you command your heart field. Now, why would we want to do that? The heart field speaks to the whole body. And it tells all the cells and your emotional body and all the aspects of your physical and spiritual self what you need. And who is telling it? Well, your soul. So you're still maintaining that witness. I am a soul that lives in my body, not the other way around. And so we are souls that have bodies. And the heart is the command center. The heart tells all the cells and all the rest of the body what you really need. And so there are some parameters around physical processing. When you shift something out of the way, such as egoic structure, that's wonderful. But you can't depend on physical processing alone to fully shift any kind of structure. It can be used for a lot of other things, though, like pain, dark energy that you picked up along the way. All sorts of interesting densities can be commanded out. So anything goes, whatever you need to shift out can go. But whenever you move something out of the way, you must energetically replace it with whatever quality of light makes best sense for you in that moment. So perhaps you're shifting pain out of your knee. Well, then you would fill in the energy using healing light or something like that. But the rule is, every time something is moved out of the way, you must be in charge of what comes to take its place. I see this problem all the time. Probably 99% of the people who come to me saying, I need help clearing. I keep doing all this clearing and it never goes away properly, are simply not doing clearing properly because they're not replacing the energy that they shifted out. And what's going to happen? Well, then you've created a vacuum. And vacuums don't stay very long in this universe. So inside the universe, there is no void or vacuum. That means that the energy you shifted might come right back, or something else that you didn't choose. So that's why processing in two steps physically is very key. We shift something out and we welcome something new in. The other parameters are that we must tell the body when to do it, and that we also need to use the breath as our enter button. So let's do a quick heart process so you can see how that feels. And I like to put my hand on my heart. You don't have to do this if you're doing it in public, obviously. And yes, you can do this anywhere. You can do it in your mind if you like, on the fly. So you can do it while you're driving. You can do it while you're in line. Doesn't matter. You can do it anytime. Good. So we'll put our hands on our hearts for now because that brings our attention there. And just say out loud with me, dear heart, please shift any dark or dense energies, any negative programs or trauma, and any negative emotions or attachments, up, down, or out, of my whole body and field now. And take a deep breath. And now we welcome something new in. And you get to choose the quality of light you replace it with. And certainly those things will be like love or healing. In this case, I'm going to call upon the pure, clear light of Source. So we'll say, dear heart, please fill my whole body and field with the pure light of Source now. And take another deep breath. Good. So many people will report that when they do physical processing, It feels like they just did a vacuum clean of their field. They feel a little lighter, and as they continue to practice with it, it actually becomes more intense. So every time I do it, I can really feel energy shifting out and light coming in. Now, once you've done all this amazing work around self-assessment, mental and emotional and physical processing, then you're in a really interesting position because you have all this fresh new space within that has light replacing, which was once egoic structure. Literally, you have just become a little more enlightened. So congratulations. And what is this enlightened state anyway? It's where there is more source and less you, less separation and more oneness. And that changes the way you approach the world. It changes the way you interact and serve in the world. It changes you. There becomes less identity and more connection. And this is, again, a very physical thing that occurs in the body. You can feel the connection. You can feel the light. You can feel the expansiveness happen to you. And that's a very good sign. So with that, then we end up in an interesting place where we've got more light coming in. That's when you want to meditate because your body's done all this amazing work and now it needs to be reconnected to the source field. And that's what meditation does for you. Now, if you're like me and have a really hard time doing classic meditation, and in this equation, really any kind of meditation is included in the equation. So I don't have a specific type of meditation that I think works better than others. I have a particular type of meditation that works really well for me because sitting quietly with my eyes shut is really hard for me to do because I'm seeing stuff with my third eye so much. So it's nearly impossible to keep my brain mind blank. So I needed a meditation that was going to have a lot more power over my brain mind because I've got a stubborn mind. And I needed one that would have a physical effect on my brain, that would calm my brain immediately. The best type of meditation I found to do that is gazing. And I highly recommend that you would enjoy looking up some articles about gazing, how to do proper gazing. It's a very ancient method of meditation, and you're going to use your open eyes to do it. And what you'll be doing is you'll be actually controlling your brain by doing some simple gazing at some sort of natural or holy structure. And a holy structure could be a mandala, sacred geometry, maybe an icon, someone that you are connected with, a guide perhaps, a picture of a guide, something from nature that shows the next beautiful equation we're going to talk about, for example, the golden ratio. But something that can help you to gaze for a certain period of time. Now, the nice thing about gazing is you're not really supposed to do it for longer than a few minutes at a time, but the profound effect that it has on the brain has been now really been looked at by science at the moment, especially around healing the brain. So, hey, if any of you have any trauma at all, me over here raising my hand, if any of us have any trauma at all, it has huge, profound effects on the brain and its structure. Gazing can help heal the brain. Gazing can help regenerate the brain. It's not a normal kind of meditation at all. And meditation in general, of course, can heal and help your brain. But gazing specifically works really well because the eyeballs are actually extensions of your brain. And when you're controlling their micro movements, you can control your brain wavelengths. So I think that's very profound. And I think it's been the best gazing or best meditation I've ever done. Gazing helps me do it whenever I get a chance, because those few moments when I'm not running a farm and raising toddlers, then I need, a few minutes, but that's all it takes then for me to plug into Source. And for those of you on a tight schedule, gazing's worth learning. Good. So just one last reiteration of our first equation, self-assessment plus mental, emotional, and physical processing plus meditation equals enlightened state. And like I said, the effects are very profound. The people who I have met who are the most enlightened use this equation in some way, shape, or form, even though they might not actually have put it out there in a certain organized way like I have today. Most of the people that you have any kind of love for out there who have a higher state of consciousness than the average person are doing something like this. And so I think that's really cool, because that means that, hey, while we don't necessarily have like a huge body of work to depend on around this next level of consciousness on the earth presently, we don't have a whole lot of work around that. We're all forerunners. We're all new at this. This is a brand new situation that nobody's been in before. And so we don't have, like I said, an ancient body of work to draw from. But that's okay. Some of the things that are working currently will continue to work. So currently, this equation is working. It's helping people attain higher states of consciousness. And that's why I consider it one of the most important equations for enlightenment. Good. So I'd like to open up for questions around this before we get into our next equation. Is there anything that's come to mind around this? Any thoughts, ideas, or questions? You can raise your hand by pressing star 2 or write me on the Q&A board. Very good. So we had some interesting comments here. Nicole would like me to address energetic boundaries and enmeshment of empathetic people and their spouses, including sharing bed space when there is a frequency mismatch. I don't mind addressing that. So when I'm looking at it, Nicole also writes, I have a stubborn mind and a stubborn third eye. I'm playing with practices from your third eye program, but not much going on there. Other spidey senses are activating, so I'd love the confirmation of experience. I feel the third eye will enhance. Any tips to quicken the process? Gazing, yes. So, Nicole, psychic development will actually get better as you shift more egoic structure out of the way. My teacher, Lucia, is a good example. She always used to get really frustrated with her third eye. Over all these years I've known her, she was frustrated about it. She could see to a certain extent, but it was always really hard for her, even as she worked really, really intensely on her psychic abilities. It wasn't until she had really done an incredible amount of processing of egoic structure that literally one day out of the blue, she wrote me and said, oh my goodness, you can't believe how psychic I am now. And here's someone who had been working at it for 50 years. And here she'd been shifting huge amounts of ego out. And what happened? She was able to use her third eye better. There's no better work you can do for your third eye than shifting egoic structure out of the way. That's the first point of advice I'd give you around the third eye. And secondly, if you have heard me speak in those classes, you'll remember that I point out that most people are using their third eye quite well. but they simply don't realize that their imagination is their third eye. And being psychic won't necessarily help you emotionally process really deeply the way you're hoping for. But I think that the combo of practicing some remote viewing and, of course, being able to do some emotional processing of egoic structure using this equation that we've just spoke about will help your psychic abilities come on board. Now, you got to kind of trick your third eye a little bit because it's used to working internally with your imagination. Instead, you're going to want to try to do some mind vacation. And so I speak about that a little bit in that class, but mind vacations are basic remote viewing where you choose a place that you're going to go look at, one that really exists. You go look at some pictures of it for a few minutes, and then you go in your imagination and you go and wander around that place. What does it smell like? What does it feel like when you touch things? What's the temperature out? What time of day is it? Use all of the other senses while you're wandering around using your imagination, this place that you just saw pictures of on the computer. And what that's going to do is it's going to trick your third eye into perceiving energy externally. But instead of focusing on what you see, you're going to focus in on all the other senses so that your brain doesn't try to control what you see. So I think mind vacations is helpful and emotional processing is helpful when you're trying to develop your third eye. Good. So those are the first two tips I have for you. And then when it comes to enmeshment with people we're close to who are on a different frequency, right? This is really quite common. Many people and on a journey of spiritual awakening end up realizing at one point, wow, my spouse is behind me on this journey. They're still very dense, and I've shifted all this density out of the way. How do I move this out of the way? How do I work with this? If you're determined to stay in your relationship, then you must depend very heavily on your own processing in order to see any difference in the person around you. So as I've continued to work on myself and get my hooks out of my husband, and my hooks mean my interest in his outcomes, no longer am I attached to those. But by golly, it takes a lot of work to unhook myself, right, from being attached to my husband's journey and his outcomes. And so that technically would mean that we're frequency-wise very different. But I absolutely cannot compress my energy in order to match his. It must be the other way around. His willingness to try to match my energy has been really amazing. But he's a special person. He's the type of guy who can feel that mismatch occurring, and he wants to fix it. So he'll either ask what he can do or what needs to be done, or we make some decisions. I want to share with you, and I don't mind being personal here. So listen, my husband and I don't sleep in the same bed. That's one of the ways I've been able to maintain our marriage, is simply because energetically, if I'm around all that density all the time, I can't handle it. I have to have a certain amount of physical space to myself. So I have my own separate bedroom and office, and he has his own separate bedroom and office. And we get to cuddle in the mornings or whatever. But simply, having a different space can be a very big and important step, I think, in unhooking ourselves in relationships from one another's outcomes. It helps with the enmeshment problem, right? So if you're trying to create a situation where the heightening of your frequency and vibration and light is going to help your husband, you need to be able to maintain that light and high frequency. That's number one, not helping your husband. Your husband being helped will happen as part of the process of you putting on the front burner at all times your own development. While I've been working on myself, I've been in situations with my own husband where I needed to attain a state of unconditional love that basically said, I am willing to continue this relationship no matter what is done or said, because I must walk my talk. I must be in a state of unconditional love. And that means that no matter what is done or said, my husband is still loved by me. Doesn't mean I have to like what he does or says. It doesn't mean I'm not going to have triggers or reactions. It means that I'm maintaining a certain frequency in my body, and I make that requirement of my body. Every single time I'm triggered, I go into the same equation, assessment, processing, meditation, never stopping. Even the most enlightened people never stop that. In fact, that's the whole point, is that you'll never stop. So that's okay. So give up on any point where you think that you're going to end up having to get to stop all this, because you don't. That's not the outcome you're looking for. The outcome's always going to require a certain amount of work to maintain. But the enmeshment, having that private space, putting your spiritual journey as the first and foremost thing that you must be working on every day, noticing the things that he's doing right, encouraging him, continuing to give him techniques and tools. If he continues to stay in a dense state of being, and there's a difficulty around him welcoming new tools or ideas from you, then that's when you need to rethink things, because you can't keep it up. You're not going to be able to continue to expand to a certain point, after a certain point, if that person is so deeply enmeshed in your life. That density won't be able to allow you to expand further. So you need to pay attention to that. There's going to be a point in time where it's going to be really clear. Hey, he's using this stuff, and he's being affected by my vibration, and he's being affected by my unconditional love. He's changing. He's forgiving himself. He's doing some processing. Then you're going to say, okay, well, the work is starting to be done. And that means that it's not going to keep me from continuing to expand. At one point in time, my husband realized, hey, I got to up the game here. I got to have my vibration higher, or I might lose my wife. It was very serious. We had a serious talk about that. And he made an incredible effort to learn things he had never learned before and to implement them. And just like any of us, being able to learn these things and continue to move forward, especially if you're an empath, and watch others to actually using those same techniques too, and trusting that they're going to keep doing that work because they really want to keep you around, well, that's going to make your life a lot easier. And it should be the number one thing that's most important to you. So the changes that happen to our friends and our family around us is very real and palpable, and sometimes they can't handle it. But if you really are truly on a path of enlightenment, that's always going to be number one. So I can't compress my field for anyone. I can't. Instead, I ask my husband to rise up to meet me, to do everything he can. And if he continues to try really hard and work at it, and I continue to do better at holding space for him to do so, then we'll be able to continue to work together and stay in this marriage. But at any point, if it stops, then I have to have another chat again. And that's okay. This is really quite hard to hear. Most people are really deeply enmeshed, aren't they? The idea of leaving a relationship because of frequency difference, that's not something we publicly talk about very often. So I'm very public about my personal experiences with this, and I think that all of us should be putting this question in our mind really consistently when it comes to our relationships. And I take a softer, gentler approach than even other teachers do, because I'm saying, hey, give them a chance. And a lot of these other teachers won't do that. They're going to say, no, you must leave. And I say, hey, if the enmeshment and the empathy is really the biggest obstacle at the moment, then really value it, because it's going to teach you more than pretty much anything if it's really the biggest obstacle at the moment. And so then this gets us into the empath piece. How does this processing, this equation, help empaths specifically? I think that empaths often are trying too hard to identify energy that is in their field. They're wondering, is it mine? Is it my husband's stuff? Is it the place? What about the collective? A lot of collective empaths that I've met, right? It's not a very common thing to be a collective empath, but for whatever reason, I have a lot of different friends and clients who are collective empaths. Collective empaths feel the collective all the time, constantly. They never get a break. So being an empath at that level is incredibly challenging, especially when the density that you're facing can be so enormous and so much bigger than you are, and often having very little to do with you in the first place. So like processing dark energy in a place, for example, well, that's the collective empath's constant experience. All the dark, dense energy gets attracted to the empath's field because you're supposed to be a giant human energetic vacuum. So you're walking around picking up dark energy. It's like it just finds you wherever it is, right? That's how most empaths describe it. Like the dark energy finds me wherever I'm at. I could be in the woods and it'd find me. Well, that's because your field is so large. Your field is so big and it's so intense. It's a giant vortex, like a big hurricane, picking energy up, especially dense energy. And first and foremost, your job as an empath is not to identify that energy. That's my job, because I'm the one who can see it, right? So it's not your job to identify it. Stop trying to identify it. Instead, what will make your life a lot easier, everything you feel, you welcome it to move. I welcome you, up, down, or out. And don't try to tell it where it needs to go. Just give it permission to go, and it will sort itself because of physics. But nonetheless, the empath's job is always to welcome everything, to use your field to shift up, down, or out of your field. That's your job. And that means all the good stuff, too. Oh, there's happiness and joy. I welcome you, happiness and joy. And you are also welcome to use my field to move up, down, or out. Ah, dark energy. Hello, dark energy. Here's some anger and some frustration. Some despair. Yes, welcome. I welcome you to use my field to move up, down, or out. And go where you need to go. The empath literally walks around dismantling dark energy. And that even happens in the field to people. So especially if you're a powerful empath and you have a husband who's got dense stuff going on, well, he probably enjoyed being in your field at first because it made him feel happier and lighter. But as he's gotten used to it, it doesn't have the same effect on him anymore, right? Or on your wife or whomever. So it doesn't have the same effects necessarily because they got used to that frequency, even though the density in their own field didn't change or shift. So that means they simply need to be commanders of their own bodies, commanders of their own densities, and learn these techniques. and learn how to assess, process, and meditate. And if it's that simple equation that you give him and the exercises to take part in, and he actually does them, then you will see a difference in him quite quickly. So that's my perspective. I know it's a little messy, but I am very grateful you brought up the question, Nicole. And so thank you. Right. So Seema says, being a collective empath is even worse if you live in a city. It's true. And we have multiple people who are certainly in collective empath mode, which is amazing to me because it's not a really super common skill set. But here's all these collective empaths. It's pretty special. Moria asks, would processing the social programming of identities like wife and husband help expedite the release of the need for control in a relationship? Oh, yeah, I think that's a smart idea. So what she's talking about is processing an identity. So if we were to mentally put that in, right, maybe an attachment to being in that identity as wife or husband. Or what would the opposite of that attachment be? A sense of not belonging in the identity of wife or husband. So that would be the polarity, not belonging in the identity of a marriage, or processing, you know, the feelings of being attached to that identity. So, yes, I do call my husband my husband because of the social norm around that. But he is an independent soul, having his own journey. That's number one. And in fact, if we really look at it, we aren't separate from each other at all, are we? We are one with the source field. The idea that I'm separate from my husband is not real. That's an illusion. And what we're trying to do is shift the illusion out of the way. So if there's an identity that you're attached to or frustrated with, that will help to shift that out of the way. That'll help you to connect in a state of oneness more deeply with the other person. Because then you're saying, hey, I'm not separate from you. This sense of separation is not real. And any kind of attachment or fear of an identity, that's going to certainly help move more structure out of the way. Good. So Nicole says, thank you very much. That was a powerful reminder. I appreciate you sharing yours and Lucia's experiences. I shall continue the deep emotional processing and focus more consistent practice. Going to work on more unhooking and separating a sleeping space. That feels freeing. I really appreciate your open sharing, and I'm receiving what you're saying. I'm at the critical point, and absolutely yes, my spiritual path is first and foremost, and I told him as much yesterday. The declaration has been made, and with it, the challenge to rise. Wow, Nicole. That's amazing. I absolutely bow to you, namaste, for that wonderful work you're doing. And certainly, all of us can be helping to heal the relationships that we have between us and other people, and that will help the collective as well. So all of this is being done in an incredible level of work. Fabulous. Yeah, so then we have another question from Susan. She says, let's see, do doorways fall under this equation for closure? Would they be considered something that should not be resisted? So what Susan's talking about is that sometimes I talk about the idea of having to shut doors behind you and opening new doors in front of you. And what I'm speaking about when I say that is shutting doors behind you. That's you fully processing any trauma or emotional baggage around the past. So now we're getting into the linear time here. When I talk about shutting doors behind you, that means you're healing your relationship with your past so that the experiences you have had in your life are not emotionally charged anymore. And that means you shut all those doors behind you. So you can use the experiences you've had as useful information instead of having an emotional charge. And then we open new doors in front of us by helping to co-create more power and velocity that is put behind a timeline of our desiring. So you have the opportunity then to create open doors, co-create with Source, open doors that help to advance a specific timeline that you're hoping to help flower and unfold and cultivate. So when we're doing emotional processing, Susan, we're closing doors behind us. And we're making room for more power, more light, so that we can open new doors in front of us. So that's a valuable way to understand how doors work, or whatever that metaphor really is. Susan also asks, how does a collective empath get the field and the heart to work automatically to move energies up, down, or out so it becomes like breathing or the heartbeat? Yeah, automatic, constant automatic is key, right? So I think that would be useful. We're always trying to make sure these processes are automatic to an extent. Someone's even mentioning too, Anda says, I process constantly without thinking about where it comes from these days. Yeah, once you get really good at processing, you'll find that you're doing it pretty much all the time to a certain extent, and that occasionally you need to dip down and do even tougher, more detailed work. But if this is something new to you, getting down and doing it and getting tough with it is going to really benefit you in the long run, because your body will get used to the idea of processing and then will be able to do it faster. So how do you get the heart field to constantly move and shift energy on its own without you having to think about it? Well, the first and best way to do that is to initially think about it constantly. So at first, for the first month or two, and it really probably even less than that if you want, because if you're doing this constantly throughout the day, it won't take more than a week or two for your body to make it an automatic process. But as for all those empaths out there, especially the collective ones with those big, huge fields of energy, if you want it to automatically be shifting stuff out of the way, then you're going to want to constantly be thinking about shifting it at first. So you're mentally going to catch yourself trying to identify stuff. And if you try to identify something, that's okay. Then you stop and you say, I welcome any of the energies I'm feeling to move up, down, or out of my field now. And then you take a deep breath. And then you fill it in with another quality of light, clear light, white light, gold light, whatever kind of light's going to work for you in that moment. And then you're going to do it again and again and again throughout your day for a week or two, maybe even longer. And what you're going to find is that then the body gets so used to it as a process that it will have written a program to keep it running without you having to think about it. So what you're trying to do basically is get your brain mind to write a program via synapses that will help run that constantly used practice over and over and over again without you having to mentally constantly be in control of it. And simply, we call this creating a habit. Basically, creating a habit is writing a new program. Not all programs are bad, obviously. In this case, we're writing a new program, but you must do it constantly for the first week or two. And then you'll find that it happens naturally. To help you with this, I've been experimenting. So this question is helpful because I've been experimenting lately about how far can we really go with commanding the heart field to do automatic processes, right? Because having to do this mentally is a lot of work. So what I do now is I've been practicing with this, and you should too, because it's a little bit of a different approach to the heart commands. In this case, then we're asking for the heart to be doing and running a specific program throughout the day. So let's do it together and see how it works for you. So if you could practice this and report back to me, let me know how it works for you, then we'll be able to experiment a little deeper with how far can we take these heart commands. So the command is, dear heart, please shift any dark or dense energy up, down, or out of my field for the rest of the day while I am awake. Now, and take a deep breath. And then we replace the energy. Dear heart, please fill my whole body and field with pure light from source throughout the whole rest of the day while I am awake. Now, and take another deep breath. Good. So again, the experiment is, can we use the heart and the brain to run physical processes automatically? And the idea is that, yes, you can create a habitual program in the mind by initially habitually doing it for a week or two, constantly, and seeing if the heart can maintain an automatic process when you've made a command to the heart and its field. And so we don't know the answer to the last one yet because we're still experimenting. But we do know that by constantly doing something for the first week or two, your brain will write a program that will allow it to happen automatically. So we want to try to use both of these things and see if that will help. Good. Glad we could talk about that. And I hope this will be helpful to you. I hope the outcome will be useful. And so Nicole asks, why do you specify while awake? Well, because when we're asleep, the processes of the human vortex tend to shift. So the human vortex isn't necessarily functioning the same way while you're awake. And furthermore, we want the body and the heart field to be able to have a break. And that's the whole point of sleeping. The body is a machine and it needs to be able to have a break. If we tell the body's heart field and the mind to constantly do things, even while asleep, it may hinder your sleep. So we need the brain and the body to have a break. And sleep is really important for the functioning of that machine. So we don't want automatic processes to run while we're asleep. I think that would mess up your sleep, and I don't know what kind of effects it would have on the field when it normally would be taking a break. So we want to respect that downtime that the body needs. That's my main approach on that. Okay, good. Really great questions. Thank you so much. And yes, just consciously noticing all those hooks that we have in attachments to outcome and outcomes that are not our own journey either. Really special. Good. This has all been very useful. Thank you so much. Let's move on to our next equation, which is my very favorite equation. And it is the golden ratio. Now, I have a little bit of a weird history with the golden ratio. I wanted to tell you a little bit about it because I wanted to do a little bit of a guided meditation for you today to help you celebrate this most precious equation within yourself. But I humbly must say that my first experiences enjoying and recognizing the power of this equation for my spiritual journey was incredibly arrogant and impure. At one point in time, I recognized that there was a very, very ancient configuration happening in my body beyond the chakra system. And I wanted to discover what was beyond the chakra system. I recognized that the chakra system, while having played an incredible important role, was not the oldest nor the most natural of configurations in the body. And when I say configuration, it simply means a way that energy moves or is utilized in a structure such as the physical form. So when I recognized the golden ratio in the body, I was just so fascinated by it because I could see the 3, 6, 9 show up in my body, and it made me feel so incredible to notice it. And I wondered, was there any other cultures that maintained the knowledge around this? And there was one, the Taoists. The Taoists taught about the Dantian centers, though they didn't extrapolate into deeper realms of the Dantian centers. They were the first and the original folks to come up with this idea that we have three brains, or three main energetic centers, the brain, the heart, and the gut. And they treated each of these centers as very special and different from one another, of course, obviously, working in combination to create a lot of power. And when I use the word power, by the way, I want you to know I'm talking about light. Light and power are the same thing. So the Taoists were able to use the Dantian centers in such a way to bring in an incredible amount of power, and their longevity is very famous. And certainly bringing in light can heal your body and help you to have long, healthy, and happy life. But the whole point is that there was this other configuration that really wasn't talked about a whole lot. There was some smatterings here and there that I could find about, oh, if you take your ear, you can map it out and there's the golden ratio. Or, you know, look at the way that your face is shaped. It's using the golden ratio. And that was super cool. And then everyone would get on with their lives. And I thought to myself, being interested in power, I thought to myself, well, I wonder if the golden ratio, if the fact that our bodies are following this pattern and the bodies and elements all around us at all levels of reality, including the quantum realms, are using the golden ratio, if this is some kind of clue into its power because the source field directly is using it. So this must mean that the golden ratio can bring in more light. This is how a spiritual scientist thinks, right? I wonder if this can bring in more power. Let's experiment. That's always what I'm thinking about. And so you can kind of get a peek into my head here. And of course, at that time, my interest in power was very arrogant. It had everything to do with making sure that I could bring in enough money to keep my family afloat, that I was going to be able to share lots of powerful healing tools with people because I wanted to save the world. I'm one of those people who've always suffered with a huge savior complex. And during this period of time, I was struggling really deeply in my life. I had very low self-esteem while still having and maintaining quite a lot of arrogance. There's that polarity of worthlessness and arrogance, right? And I was appeared to by a beautiful being that I thought was an angel. And this, by the way, I'm just saying this out loud for those of you who've been struggling with your third eye. This is why being very psychic and not being able to feel energy like an empath or know or tap into that divine knowing in my gut, why being just purely psychic and not having the use of my heart and gut has always been an incredible, dangerous detriment to me. So this is the period of time where I learned that using my empath abilities, being able to feel into the reality of an energy and to touch base with source through my gut and the earth through my gut and know whether or not something's safe or not, why that ended up becoming so important to me, because this experience nearly killed me. And it was because I believed what I saw 100%. I didn't feel into the energy. I didn't tap into my divine knowing. I saw what looked like a powerful angel, and I believed it was a powerful angel. And it was not. It was a very powerful demon. And this thing literally showed up in my bedroom. And it's standing there, and it says to me, "Do you want to be able to heal the world?" You know, that should have been a red flag. Come on. Right? But I totally fell for it. Totally fell for it. See, it doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how good of a psychic you are. We are still incredibly fallible. Me especially. And so I said, "Well, yes, of course I do." And this being said, "I want to show you something that is special and exclusive that only you will know, and you can teach this." Another huge red flag. I was being singled out as special. They were petting my ego, right? And, "Do you want to help heal the world?" Not one specific individual can help heal the world. We must do it together. Again, putting me and separating me from my experience, and then putting me in a sort of separate box, right? A separate pedestal. "You're special, Elizabeth. You're going to be able to help heal the planet." And then, of course, what happened was very simple. This demonic being proceeded to show me how to use the golden ratio like black magic, that I could use it as a form to put power into things, places, situations, or people. The key word here is using. What I'm going to show you today is the exact opposite. We're not going to use the golden ratio. Instead, the golden ratio is using us already. We are being used. That's how it should be. Source works through us. Source uses the golden ratio and helps to create these bodies. Source uses the golden ratio and helps to create a tree, the earth, the sun, the solar system, the galaxies, the atoms, the molecules. Source uses this tool, not us. And I was being told by this being that I could use this tool just like God. Amazing how arrogant I was in that moment to say yes, and then begin to practice with it. And lo and behold, certainly I got outcomes. Yes, I got lots of outcomes. I got some amazing outcomes and some horrifying outcomes. Because we're not here to use Source. And that's exactly what I was doing. And I paid big time. Every time you make a deal with a demon, you have to pay. So I made a deal, and I had to pay. Of course, I didn't think it was a demon until later. Then I realized what had happened. And at that point, I was well entrapped. And I had to clean up my mess. Nearly my whole entire farm full of animals died. I almost lost my marriage. I could have easily lost my life, and I didn't. thank God, because I cleaned it up. I made sure and paid all that money back. I went into public radio and I told everybody publicly how bad I'd screwed up and warned everybody. I taught a 4-hour-long class about it. And you can find it on my website if you want it. It's with the series of Practicing with Light series, and it's the Mechanics of False Light is the class. And it comes along with two other classes about light, practicing with light and rainbow gazing. But in that course, that 4-hour-long discussion, I speak very in detail about what had happened, why I ended up using the golden ratio as a tool of magic to put power where I wanted to put power. Amazing. So what I learned, the biggest lesson that I learned about the golden ratio in all of this is two things. One, that it is incredibly powerful. But that power is so big and so amazing and so mind-blowing that none of us have the capacity to fully understand or use it. Only Source does. And secondly, that by celebrating the golden ratio in my own body, I could tap into the Source field who is using that great power and using me simultaneously. That I could tap into and connect myself back to the Source field in a deeper way by celebrating the existence of this wonderful equation, the 369. And so by switching that mindset from arrogance and wanting to use that golden ratio to bring in more power or to have control over power, I completely flip-flopped into a more humble and more enlightened state after cleaning up my mess and continuing to teach about my mess that I had created for many years. But I was able to enter into a place of humility where instead I could celebrate its existence and its power. Because we don't have to use this equation. The equation is using us. It's already in us. It's already part of our body at every level, and it connects us to how wonderfully huge and complex and powerful Source really is. It's a good reminder that we are of the Source field and that the Source field uses us. I'd like to walk you through a meditation to celebrate this beautiful golden ratio in our bodies right now. And I want to make sure to answer any questions about this before we get into it. So do you have anything that came up for you as I was describing to you the importance of this equation, the 369? If you'd like to speak to me live, you can press star 2 or just write on the Q&A board. I just want to make sure and speak to you clearly about any questions that you might have. Oh, thank you. Someone actually has heard the class I was talking about, The Mechanics of False Light. Yeah, very glad to be able to keep that on the plate. I want people to have access to it because I think it's so important to hear. And certainly one of the greatest lessons I've ever had. Very good. All right, looks like we're okay. So here we are. Let's begin this beautiful meditation. It won't take very long, but I hope that you'll be able to get a lot of use out of it. All right. Well, this is how I do it. Let's begin at the crown. So we're going to go ahead and touch the top of your head, okay? We're going to touch certain parts of the body in this meditation. As we put our hand on our heads, I want you to draw a little bit of a circle on the crown and then draw a line from the crown down to the third eye and rub a circle on your third eye. I like to go up on the right and down on the left. Good. And so then we'll say, Dear Source, please fill my whole mind, my whole brain, with pure white light that will shift any densities and negative programs and replace it with more humility and more peace. Take a big deep breath. Now draw a line down the front of your face, down to the heart. And I like to rub a little circle there too. Dear Source, please fill my heart with pure white light to shift any densities or obstacles out of my way so that I may embody higher dimensions of light and become one with you. And now take a deep breath. And now draw a line down to your belly button. And take the full palm of your hand and rub down on the left, up on the right, round and round, big circle. And we'll say, Dear Source, please fill my whole gut and organs, my whole root and pelvis, with pure white light, so that it may shift any dark or dense energies out and help me embody higher dimensions to become more one with you. And take a deep breath into your belly. And then we ask, Dear Source, please help connect my brain. You can touch your head. My heart. Touch your heart. And my gut. Touch your belly button. To connect fully. Help me feel the foundation of the golden ratio in my body. And take a deep breath. And now we ask, Dear Source, please help balance my right and left side, where the division of 3 becomes 6. Please help balance my temples, my jaw, my neck, my shoulders, my elbows, and my wrists, all the bones in my fingers. Please help balance my rib cage, my spine, my pelvis, my hips, my knees, my ankles, and all the bones of my feet. I ask you to help me find balance fully in my body now. And take another deep breath. And now we ask for 9. The number of oneness, the number of infinity, which connects us to the infinite creative nature of Source. You can ask from the heart, Dear Source, please help me welcome full and total oneness into the Source field. Help my whole body as one body connect entirely to that field. And I want you to visualize that core of light expanding within you to fill you in like a whole big bubble. Fill in your whole field with light. And take a nice big deep breath. Good. So what we've done is we've welcomed the three minds to work together and to be filled with light, the brain, the heart, and the gut, the core of the golden ratio in the body. Then we recognize the right and left side, that our bodies are, of course, just like the golden ratio. When you split that three into two threes, then you get six. And then we found all the different spots in our body where that division occurs through all the different joints of the body. And we welcomed light into that. And then lastly, we welcome light into the wholeness of our whole self, oneness, which is that number nine. And number nine, when it's multiplied by any other numbers, the sum of that final answer is always nine. It's just a wonderful mathematical equation and example that shows us how connected to the source field we are. And by celebrating it within ourselves, we can become even more connected and recognize very physically that connection. This helps you embody higher dimensions, helps you embody light, and it helps you to stop feeling separated from the source field, who uses the power of the golden ratio to create this universe. Good. So are there any questions? How did that feel? Did it feel good to recognize the golden ratio in the body? You can press star 2 to speak live with me, or you can write on the Q&A as you wish. I really love that particular meditation. It's what I do every day, and it's helped me immensely to feel more connected to the source field. Certainly, many different ways to recognize that ratio everywhere in your reality, and recognizing it in yourself simultaneously can be a very profound and subtle shift that your mind can make, which will welcome higher states of consciousness. Good. Yes. So Nicole said that she loved that, and 666 is really the structure of carbon. And that seems relevant. Yes, absolutely. And you'll find that the 369 showing up in different capacities, now that you're kind of tuning into noticing this ratio and how the source field uses it constantly, I think it'll be kind of fun because you're going to notice it everywhere. You're going to notice it in number patterns when it comes to, say, for example, atomic numbers. You're going to notice it in shapes and forms and structures of all sorts, even systems. So I think that's going to help you even deeper, subtly, subconsciously connect to the source field. Good. Very glad to share that with you. And certainly much better to use the 369 as a celebration of what source has created within us than us to use it thinking we can be in control of all that power, right? So don't be like me. or at least the way I was. Very good. All right, let's move forward. And I think we can probably say we've got about a half hour more or so. All right, so this next equation, the last equation of the day, thanks for spending all this time with me, but the last equation of the day is actually a form. It's a form. So here, first we had an equation that was a series of steps that created a formula. Then the second was a mathematical equation that also creates a form out there. And this one is also sort of like that. It's a form, which is a sacred geometric form. And certainly at its foundation, it's an equation. And this particular form has a very interesting history. And what it is it's the Sri Yantra. So the Sri Yantra, is a specific mandala. It's a form. And this form has been shown to have some really interesting properties. So to kind of bring it all around, I believe that the Sri Yantra used in combination with gazing meditation and the recognition of the golden ratio and the celebration of the golden ratio, I believe that to be a very high type of meditation that takes gazing to a whole nother level. It takes the celebration of the source field and the mathematical equations that the source field uses to create reality to a whole nother level. And it can connect you and your soul and your body to the source field when used properly. So the Sri Yantra, you've seen it before, it's a really interesting structure that's also commonly known in ancient times to be incredibly hard to draw because it has to be done so precisely that it's nearly impossible to do well. So as you can imagine, those who've mastered the ability to create the Sri Yantra have had to have an incredible amount of experience. So one of the things that I was looking at around the Sri Yantra is there any modern science that actually can point us in the direction to understand how powerful this is? What does the utilization of this beautiful mandala, what does that actually do to the brain? Do we have any evidence in science that shows us that this is better than, say, a different mandala or a picture or what? And it turns out that in 1987, there were Russian scientists who used EEG technology. So they put a whole bunch of people into their experiment and they put lots of different nodes onto their heads so they could study brainwave patterns. And they noticed that the Sri Yantra geometrically very quickly brings the viewer into a meditative space, which means that the brain wavelengths change really fast. And it shows that they can reach these really fabulous brainwave levels that we want that helps us connect to higher consciousness, that it helps bring that on in the brain. Just the shape of that mandala and them gazing at it was able to bring them into high states of consciousness immediately. And you can actually find this study yourself, and you can actually look it up. It was done at the biology faculty at Moscow University on October 30th in 1987. So there is physical evidence that shows in science that even the scientists have been baffled about. Why would a mathematical structure of sacred geometry create an immediate effect on the brain wavelengths to allow more light in? Because that's what those brain wavelengths do. When you go into theta and gamma brain wavelengths, and you're doing it consciously while awake, and you're bringing in more light, and you can have access to, say, for example, more psychic experiences, more connection to source, more feelings of love and support from the universe, less separation, all the basic things you need to be able to embody higher dimensions, which is the whole point, right? So why in the world would that be the case? Well, it turns out that the Sri Yantra comes from cymatics. We don't really know the full history of it, but ancient sort of documents point to the fact that the Sri Yantra may have even come from extraterrestrials who taught it to us as a powerful tool to help our ascension. And it was given to ancient humans and has played a very important role in our energetic history. And so it is nice to know exactly how the ancient people saw this Sri Yantra. And they called it the Sri Yantra for a reason. So the word yantra actually comes from the root word yam, which means instrument or support, and tra, which is derived from the word trana, meaning release from bondage. So it's an instrument or tool for meditation and contemplation that supports spiritual liberation. They considered it a tool, and we should too. It is an equation for enlightenment. So, of course, there's hundreds of yantra designs, and they're used in ceremonies and rituals all over the world. And they're made from all sorts of materials. And traditionally, the Sri Yantra would have been embossed on a copper plate that would have had gold laid over it. So it would have been a golden specific object of copper that had gold plate on it. And it would be tuned to a specific vibration or energy. And then once it's tuned or charged, that plate becomes a sacred object, because that plate is then tuned to bring through whatever the Sri Yantra's energetic vibration frequency pattern is in order to bring it through. So then you're having a multidimensional experience when you're working with a yantra that's been tuned, especially on a copper plate. You're having an experience of being able to physically feel the vibration or frequency. At least your cells can, if you can't directly. Your body still is perceiving the frequency. And that frequency directly relates to the form that's on it, because frequency creates form, and form can be directly tied back to frequency. So the yantra itself is expressing a frequency, and when tuned properly, it's going to have a physical effect. So you're not only getting that very cellular effect from the yantra itself, but then you're visually tuning into it with your brain mind, who itself, as a biological organ, can recognize how much light this particular form brings in, like a window to source, right? So you can physically have an effect then on the brain from the frequency itself, and then from the meditation upon it. So it's a triple effect here. If you're doing gazing on this particular yantra, you're having a triple effect on your body. So this is like taking gazing to, you know, a whole nother level, basically. And it's something the ancient people experimented with a lot. So we do have a body of work that proves that this yantra can especially be helpful in your enlightenment. It's called the Queen of Yantras because it's the symbol of the great divine mother principle, the source of all energy, power, and creativity. So it's known as the source. It's a window into the source of creativity. It was often regarded in ancient Vedic schools as the representation of the universe, as well as the representation of the body, as related to, of course, the feminine principle. So every line, triangle, and petal in that yantra symbolizes a specific type of energy, which the Vedic teachers called Shakti, specific type of light energy coming from source. So if we were to examine this a little more carefully so that we can really understand why the representations are so important and why the Vedic teachers saw this as one of their number one ways to help bring enlightenment into their lives? Well, we'd want to examine all the pieces of the yantra. So the outer square is the most striking form, I think, of the yantra. It represents the earth, and it corresponds to the mundane emotions also, such as anger, fear, and worldly desires, so earthly emotions. So when the yogi meditates on the outer square, they meditate in order to defeat the disturbance of those energies, the disturbance of anger, fear, and worldly desire. And there's these T-shaped structures in the square. Those are considered gates of the four directions and the entry points of the yantra. So the yantra is coming in from four directions at once. And when drawn properly, the square will maintain a golden ratio within it, which is really interesting. It kind of ties back to that golden ratio a little bit. So then the next most striking part of the yantra is the three circles, and they represent the past, present, and future. Within is the first ring of 16 lotus petals, of course, representing complete fulfillment of all hopes and desires. So you'll see the circles, but then there's the first ring, and you'll see those lotus petals there, 16 lotus petals specifically. And they represent the 10 organs of perception and action in ancient Vedic teaching. The tongue, the nose, the mouth, the skin, the eyes, ears, feet, hands, arms, and the reproductive organs. And they also represent the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space. And the 16th petal represents the mind, which gathers and interprets information. So next is an 8-petal lotus. Each petal governs a specific activity, speech, grasping, motion, excretion, enjoyment, revulsion, attraction, and equanimity. And within that first, within the inner lotus is that first set of the interlocked triangles, which is so fascinating. And those that point upward, they represent the masculine, and downward represent the feminine. Those triangles also represent qualities and shaktis, different energies of light. And then starting at the lowermost triangle, the outer triangle, and moving in a counterclockwise circle, those different energies are agitation, pursuit, attraction, delight, delusion, immobility, release, control, pleasure, intoxication, accomplishment of desire, luxury, mantra, and the destruction of duality. So incredibly, very detailed meaning put behind this, even though at its root it is not filled with meaning, but rather we put significance and meaning on it. It was a way to organize the path to enlightenment for those who recognize it and understood it. Now, the next circle also has the same sequence and direction, starting from the lowest triangle and moving counterclockwise. The first triangle is the giver of all accomplishment, the next is the giver of wealth, and the third is the energy of activities that please all. The fourth is the bringer of all blessings, the fifth is the granter of all desires, the next is the remover of all suffering, and the seventh is the appeaser of death. The eighth is the overcoming of all obstacles. And the ninth is the bringer of beauty. And the last, the tenth, is the giver of good fortune. The 10 smaller triangles in the third circle actually represent beginning at the same lower point triangle and moving counterclockwise some really specific attributes, which I'll list here quickly for you. Those attributes are omniscience, omnipotence, sovereignty. Some people like to say it sovereignty. I often say it wrong. Sovereignty, knowledge, destruction of all disease, unconditional support, the vanquishment of all evils, protection, and the attainment of all desires. The fourth circle of triangles, again, starting at the same point, represents sustaining, creating, disillusion, pleasure, pain, cold, heat, and the ability to choose action. And the final inner space, the yogi or yogini visualizes five arrows representing the world of the senses, a bow representing the mind, a noose representing attachment, and a stick representing aversion. The central triangle is the giver of all perfection, and in the middle of the central triangle is a bindu representing pure consciousness and the original state of being. So why did I tell you all this? Why did I list it all off and then promptly tell you that we've placed all this meaning on this thing? I'm not trying to devalue the meaning by any means whatsoever. Humans put lots of significance on lots of things, and that's really important for each individual. But what we have here is a very, very long tradition of utilizing this particular form, which comes straight from source through the discovery of cymatics. Cymatics is spelled C-Y-M-A-T-I-C-S. Cymatics is how frequency creates form. But what we have is actually a very historic object, an object that through its meaning that it's been receiving from us has helped many, many people bring in more light and energy into their life. And I think that's really important. So we need to know what are the historical teachings that are embedded in this object by human beings over history, over time. And that's why we listed all these pieces out. So then you too can go and actually look back, perhaps take some notes if you want to go back to the recording. Go look back at those notes and follow some of these patterns. In meditation, use your eyes and your mind to walk through this journey. And one of the common things we can kind of see that the ancient people did when they were using this information is they were using the Sri Yantra to organize their teachings and to help people walk a path of enlightenment. Their ultimate goals, you know, are these really epic, big, huge things like the end of all disease, right, or the attaining of source consciousness. And that's the same for us. In this case, we're asking, too, for it to help us to embody all of these higher states, not just to get the mind free. So that's the difference between what ancient people were doing. They were trying to enlighten their minds. And what we're doing, we're here to enlighten our minds, but also to embody that enlightenment, an additional step, which was originally part of our experiment here. And now it's been reset, so that's the job. Embodying higher dimensions while still living in the 3D. Bringing it all down into the 3D, being a bridge between the 3D and all higher dimensions. That was always the original experiment. And the Sri Yantra was given to us as a gift to help us remember and maintain that path. So how do you use this? Well, you're going to do gazing with this. So I want to give you simple gazing instructions real fast. because I think that'll be key. It was one of the things I mentioned earlier as part of the equation, the first equation of enlightenment. So I'll give you an easy way to do that. First, you're going to find a comfortable place to sit that allows you to remain alert, right? Because if you're super sleepy and you lay back, you might fall asleep and then miss out on meditating. So have your Sri Yantra image on hand and put the yantra on a blank surface if you can. So maybe a white wall if you can. That's ideal. And you just want to have a nice clear view of it. You want the image no more than about 3 to 4 feet in front of you because you need to be able to stare quite directly at it. And have your eyes focused very centrally on it. If it's too far away, then there's too much for the eyes to get distracted by. And then you can set a timer if you want, but I don't like using timers because then they annoy me. But if you want a timer, set it for 5 minutes. That way you know you've done your full 5 minutes. Really, you shouldn't necessarily do gazing for longer than 5 minutes at a time. Then you got to stare at the yantra, obviously, but you're going to keep your gaze very soft. You're going to try to keep your gaze as directly horizontal and, of course, parallel at the center of an XY axis in your head as possible. So if the Sri Yantra is right directly in front of your line of sight, that's key. If it's a little too high or a little too low, then your eyes aren't going to be staring directly at the point that you want them to. The placing of your eyes is important in this, because the way your eyes will relax and begin to start to fade into the yantra is your clue that you're doing it right. I'll describe that in a moment. But it's best done with that nice central specific gaze. Then you'll relax and let your gaze be soft. Passively allow the image to be in your awareness. You're not trying to stare at it as if it's going to open or something. You're going to gently and passively gaze at it, but stay focused on the image. If your mind wanders, just bring it right back without any reactions. And what you want to see is the image will begin to fade a little bit. It might begin to disappear, and that's great. That means that you've entered into proper gazing. What that is that the micro movements of your eyeballs have stopped, because your eyes are constantly making little micro movements, which allow light to bounce around enough for you to see images pretty consistently. And when you stop those micro movements, things actually kind of disappear at your central gaze. And that's okay. That's exactly what you want. Once this happens, you know that you've attained that level of gazing you want. You can hold it as long as you can till you're ready to let go. Of course, at any point, if it's uncomfortable, stop. If you blink, don't worry. It's not going to end everything. Just keep doing it as long as you can. But you will probably be trying to keep your eyes open as wide as you can and not letting your eyes blink. Now, what this does to the brain is it balances out both the front and the back parts of the brain and the right and left side. It creates harmony in the brain and then simultaneously brings on higher levels of brain waves by using this particular shape as well. So the shape, the formula, the equation of the Sri Yantra is what we're using here to bring more enlightenment in and to complement part of our first equation of enlightenment, which included meditation of some kind. So we're linking them all together. And of course, you'll see, as well as anyone can, that there is a lot of golden ratio happening within the Sri Yantra. It's very spectacular how much 369 there is happening there. And perhaps while you're doing gazing, you can simultaneously be welcoming and celebrating the golden ratio in your body as well. So I find that this particular form is very profound in its history, and I treat it like an equation for enlightenment, because not only do we have historical factors which point to us as it being very powerful for our enlightenment process, but we even have some science to show that that's true as well. And certainly, as we're bridging science and spirituality together, that's incredibly valuable for the work we're doing at the moment on enlightenment. So that is the basis of my talk for you today, and we have spent 2.5 hours together. I would love to answer any questions that have come up, whatever they might be around. Please go ahead and feel free to write that on the Q&A board, or we can talk live for a few minutes. Press star 2. Nicole writes, speaking of cymatics, what are your feelings about using sonic tools in meditation such as binaural beats, subliminals, hypnosis, etc., to alter brain states and reprogram our subconscious, among many other things? Yes, absolutely. And Nicole mentioned she's been drawn to use it again, and now she realizes why. Very cool. Yes, so I absolutely say whatever makes your meditations deeper and easier for you, if binaural beats, subliminals, hypnosis does that, then use it. I think there's so many tools. You know, there's a lot more we could talk about bringing in qualities of light. And when I say qualities of light, you know, that's another thing that really didn't apply necessarily to equations today, but being able to use light. Different wavelengths of light have different intelligences, and those wavelengths of light create different forms. And wavelengths of light can be directly tied to sound. So those same wavelengths, they represent different sounds as well. And so light and sound are representing and helping to create reality. And the utilization of light and sound is certainly going to be helpful to all of us to use as tools to help bring in more enlightenment. The goal always being to shift density and structure out of the way and bring in a lot more power. So I think, yes, whatever makes your world more expansive, whatever helps to break down any barriers of separation for you, if it's hypnosis or binaural beats, do it. I personally don't find that they help me, but I actually think my brain is it's wired really different. So there's certain things that other folks can do that I really can't. And that's a huge limitation for me, certainly, on my end, being very highly psychic. I'm also synesthetic, which means I can see sound. So any sound that I hear actually has colors and forms. And that makes my life really interesting and very busy and loud and intense. So when I'm listening to binaural beats or different esophageal tones or things like that, I'm not listening to it in order to meditate, because it definitely does the opposite for me. I see a lot more when I hear sound. But for others, that might actually be different. It actually would help their brains and help them to be able to subconsciously shift trauma out of the way and welcome in higher states of light. And there's other things that we haven't covered that aren't equations necessarily. Today I really wanted to focus in on the three top things that I think help us to bring in more enlightenment. And there's a long list of things that are not necessarily mathematically or equation based. And that's okay. But as you got a good taste today, if I was to basically say, these are the top tools I use, that's what we're looking at today. What are the top tools that I as a teacher use? What are my experiences with that? How do those work for me? And how have they been able to be applied historically for other people too in their enlightenment process? Do other people have the same kind of results when they use these equations? Yes, certainly they do. And that's why we wanted to bring it up today, to recognize their significance, but not to downplay any other things that might be useful to you. It gives you kind of a cool way to think of things, too, always asking, is this tool that I'm using, is this new spiritual tool or this activation or this sound or whatever, is it bringing in more light? Is it helping me to retain more light? Is it helping me to shift dense energy out? Is it one of those things or all of the above? We can do a really good assessment of our own tools. And this kind of gives you a clear mindset about doing that when you're able to start thinking of things in terms of, if these things are done, then this will bring in more light, or if these things are done, then this will help me attain higher states of enlightened consciousness. And that's constantly how I'm looking at the world. Is this food going to help me do that? Is this relationship going to help me do that? Is this activity going to help me do that? And that can be really a big, profound mindset shift for folks. Because a lot of times we're driven into just having to try to get by and survive, right? Whew. It relieves us of some of that constant work on survival. Good. Let's see. So Seema's asking a good question. You can use gazing meditation a few times a day for 5 or 10 minutes each time rather than 20 or 30 minutes of daily meditation. Well, honestly, Seema, sometimes I get 5 minutes and then I'm happy. I use gazing meditation because it's fast, because you don't have to do it for 20, 30 minutes a day. You can do it for 5 minutes and still get a lot of beauty out of your meditation. I'm saying use gazing meditation, you know, for those days when you're having a hard time doing your regular classic meditation that's worked for you, if you already have a practice. I mean, honestly, Lucia's meditating for hours a day. And I certainly would too if I had the lifestyle that she has. No small children and a working farm and a daily constant business, right? So, and I'm not saying she's not running her business. I'm saying that she's set her life up in such a way that she can bring in an incredible amount of light and easily step aside for multiple hours a day to meditate. That's fabulous. It's something I'm shooting for sure. But if you've only got 5 minutes, like me, then gazing can help immensely, because you can get into a higher brainwave state with gazing, especially with the Sri Yantra, faster than pretty much any other kind of meditation. So you might even be able to mix and match it a little bit. Perhaps try and start out with the Sri Yantra gazing and then go into a really deep classic eyes closed meditation from there. To get your brain jump-started into those higher states, then you might be able to have a nice, super long, beautiful classic meditation afterwards. So you could use it like that, or you could use it on the fly when you just don't have time to meditate, but then other days do some deeper classic 20, 30-minute or more long meditations. So I'm certainly not saying to replace your meditations with this. I'm saying it's a really powerful tool that you can use in addition to what you're already doing. Or like me, if if it's all you can do, then great. It's fast. That's what's so cool about it, is it's super fast. So you don't have to wait 5, 10, 15 minutes trying to get your brain to go into that state. You can take it right in, using the Sri Yantra and gazing simultaneously, preferably after you've done some self-assessment and processing, right? Okay, good. All right. So, Nikki, thank you. You have your hand raised, and you are my only person who's talking to me today live, which is great.
Well, I feel very special.
Good. Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
I'm very serious about that. I don't mean that to be, it sounded sarcastic, but that tends to be my default. So I didn't mean it to be, I feel very
special. Oh, you're not. You're fine.
Anyway, two things come up about meditation. One is that I'm finding, because I'm a hermit, and so I have to be careful because my challenge is dealing with people, right? So,
yeah. So
I can get lost, and I have to force myself to go and interact with humans. So I do that. I mean, I do that regularly, like not every day because I live alone. So I have to be careful because I don't have toddlers or a spouse. But what I wanted to say was, you know, it's sort of the flip side of what you're doing. My meditation tends to be, and I'm sure you do this too with your activities, but I find myself in meditation with action now, much more so than I did years ago, where I would have to kind of force myself to stop and sit. But because I'm not working right now, I find that there's, you know, certain activities where I'm in meditation the whole time I'm doing it, and I don't sometimes even know until I'm done, and I'm like, oh, I was, you know.
Right.
So that's one thing. And I find that two things that do that, of course, are art and preparing food is where I really find that I've gone into a really deep meditative state without trying.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted, so I was just saying that, you know, for me, it's two kind of two things I'm asking is, or I'm really pointing out, I guess, I'm asking, is that for those of us who tend to be isolated and or choose to be alone most of the time, if we had our druthers, it can be kind of a, you know, a dangerous situation to not, because then I find when I go and interact with people, it's really challenging if I've waited too long.
Ah, yeah, if you've waited too long. Oh, that's a good point.
So I have to bring myself to, and, you know, my fairy side doesn't want any pattern. I mean, I don't like to say every other day or whatever, so I try to incorporate discipline into my flightiness and my you know, not wanting to have rules, et cetera.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to point out is I remember on a call recently, you had a caller who was talking about her relationship to mandalas.
Yes.
And I thought about something that's probably going to bring me to tears, but when my mom was in her last years, I bought her this beautiful mandala book. This was, I don't know, back like in 2011 or something like that. And what I found, she was an artist, but she had lost her dexterity, so she couldn't paint anymore. But she was always wanting to use color and her hands.
Yeah.
And so she would spend hours in the last 2 years of her life coloring mandalas, like book full of mandalas. And what I found was that it transformed her. Doing that brought her to a place of peace that I never experienced or knew from her previously. So I would call it, you said, you know, you talked about habit, but it was almost an addiction, because it brought her such peace that she became really, you know, I mean, I have all of her art supplies still that I've kept to this day, and she had more kinds of color in her life than anyone had ever seen. But anyway, I think the mandalas for her were a meditation that was just a beautiful process that brought her to an incredibly peaceful place when she passed.
I'm really glad you brought this up, because I just posted an article on social media the other day about how coloring mandalas, especially, how coloring can act as a incredibly profound type of meditation.
Yeah.
And that kind of leads us into, you know, are there states of consciousness where you are meditating constantly? You're already in those higher states? Yeah, absolutely. And what happens to people is like what has happened to you, where you find yourself already in high states of consciousness while you're doing things that, you know, earlier in your life, you wouldn't have necessarily maintained that state of consciousness while preparing food or coloring necessarily. But now at this point, all that work you've done, and then the consistent practicing, teaching your brain how to be in those states, well, now it's interested in being in those states more often. And I don't doubt that coloring mandalas made a profound energetic difference on your mom at all. I've heard that before. Your story is very special. Thank you for sharing that very much. I do think that eventually people do end up in states of meditation. Like when I'm doing sessions, I'm often doing sessions for 8-9 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be in a state of meditation to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do a proper seeing or reading for someone and be in a state of an oracle without being in a super high state of consciousness, which is akin to meditation. So when I say, hey, I wish I could meditate for 2 hours a day, I kind of already am.
Well, right. That's what I was going to say, because your farm and your spouse and your children are your ground to 3D in a way that, you know,
yes.
So you get to go back and forth more than you probably realize between when you're doing your sessions and your calls. You're certainly in a, you know, high state, and we can call it meditation, but whatever it is, it's different than when you're feeding the chickens and
yes.
you know, dealing with a boo-boo
right.
or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I mean, they're all meditation, really. It's just that it's wonderful that you have that ability to kind of, I see it as the skids, you know. It's like you can kind of
for
slide.
Sure.
I can see you on like a not
yeah,
a skateboard,
slide in
but,
and
you know,
out.
You're sliding back and forth between those places, but really, in a way, it's all the same, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that for those of us who tend to be in a rural area living alone, it's going out to get triggered.
Going out to get triggered. It's like, oh, great. Yeah exactly. Even like
okay,
trying to muster up the desire to get out
beautiful.
There.
Beautiful.
You're so
class.
Welcome, Nikki.
Really fabulous.
Thank you.
You're just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting. And I'll just add that, yes, all this sounds really great, like being able to do sessions and be in a meditative state and then be able to have those interesting grounding factors like a family and a farm and those sorts of things. And it might even sound cool to listen to sound and see color. However, with all of the above and being as psychic as I am, there's certain things I can't do, like drive. I've never had a driver's license. I simply cannot drive. I've tried. and my problems that I'm pulled in and out of different states of consciousness, so it's dangerous for me to drive. I don't know if I'm going to have a vision or if I'm going to have beings appear to me or if I'll have some kind of messages come through, or I never know what's going to happen when. And sometimes it happens while I'm in a car. So learning how to drive has been a huge challenge for me, and I just have finally kind of given up on it simply because I'm not always fully in control of the information that gets to come through and when it does. So it's timing, really. And just to make sure everybody else is safe on the road, I don't drive. So that's one of those sort of random things that, you know, folks with special gifts, they can sometimes get put on a pedestal. Oh, it's so cool. I wish I could be that psychic. And I laugh and say, well, would you be willing to depend on everyone else in your life to drive you around? How many things that you're really used to and comfortable with would you be willing to give up? And if you really wanted to attain that level of gift, there's a lot of things we give up, too. So just painting a real picture on that, you know, what is that like to see constantly the way that I do? Well, it's disabled me in some ways, and that's okay. I'm used to it now. And I've just kind of settled into being who I am. But it certainly hasn't been an easy road. Nonetheless, the ultimate goal is to continue to attain those higher states and maintain them, bringing in extra light. And I hope that these equations will serve you. And I'm so glad and proud that I got to share them with you today. So... yes, Anda, there is a replay, always, of every class I do, I always record them, and Nicole asks, the Sri Yantra, do the colors matter, or just the pattern? No, the colors don't matter, and yes, you can certainly bring one out and color it yourself, and yes, I'm very glad that you've had an openness today. Thank you, Nicole, for sharing. And bless you, Petra, for staying up so late to listen. Sweet dreams. But thank you all so very much. I'm so glad that I got to share this info with you. And I love you very much. And I hope that you'll enjoy the song that I play at the end of all my classes. And if you have any further questions, or would like to sign up for my newsletter so you can be updated on the next classes and series that I'm doing, you can go to seerandscientist.com. Or if you'd like to connect with me directly via email, my email is elizabeth@seerandscientist.com. And seer is spelled S-E-E-R. Very good. Bless you all. Have a wonderful evening. And I'm just so glad that you got to join me today. Thank you.